No one has higher expectations for higher education than this week's Game Face exec, Dr. Bridget Madrian, the first female dean of Brigham Young University's Marriott School of Business. Now in her third year leading a program that Bloomberg Businessweek named as the best at producing trained MBA graduates, Bridget leads a business school that also boasts top rankings in accounting, HR, and entrepreneurship. Formerly a faculty member at such renowned institutions as Harvard, the University of Chicago, and Wharton, how is this native Utahn helping to transform a school steeped in tradition? It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Bridget Madrian, the Dean of the Marriott School at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. And Dean Madrian, you know that I've wanted to have you on this podcast for some time. Sometimes we pass in the hallways at BYU. I don't know if you were avoiding my glance, but you finally succumbed and agreed to come onto my podcast. I know you're a busy woman, so thank you for joining me.
Rob, good to be here.
So for those who aren't very familiar with the world of academia, and some of my listeners and viewers may not huddle around the halls of a campus like you do each and every day, I'd like to just kind of start from the beginning, if we could, and describe what the dean of a business school does, especially in today's world of academia, which I presume is constantly evolving. So how would you describe your role, Dean Madrian?
Boy, that's a great question, and not a question I actually get asked very often. My job is to make sure that the business school at Brigham Young University is doing what it's supposed to do. And of course, our primary mission is to educate students. So we hire faculty, we decide what classes they're going to teach, we decide what kind of programs we're going to run. And as the market evolves, we make changes to some of those things. And then I'm also involved in a lot of people development, because the business school is an organization like any organization, and we have lots of employees and need to make decisions about what their jobs are going to look like, how well they're doing, hiring decisions, promotion decisions. And of course, you're always trying to get the best out of the people that you have, inspire them to do the best that they can in their jobs, figure out what opportunities might lie ahead and how to prepare them. And at a business school, that's exactly what you're also trying to teach your students to do. So a business school is an interesting place to do all of this. You kind of need to practice what you're preaching to your students. And sometimes you discover there's a little bit of a disconnect there.
So it sounds like you described the role of a chief executive officer of a school. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think that's a good characterization.
And approximately how many employees then are under the roof of the Tanner Building where the BYU Marriott School is located?
So it depends on how you count them. So we have about 140 full-time faculty members and 85-ish full-time staff. We have another maybe 80 adjunct faculty who teach part-time. And then we have a vast army of student employees. So over the course of a calendar year, we employ about 1,500 students doing various things in the business school. And that's a different model than a lot of other academic institutions have. We rely really heavily on students to do work that at other universities you would hire full-time employees to do. And it's a great learning opportunity for students on campus. They get handed responsibilities that they wouldn't get if they were students anywhere else in the country. And they get a lot of really great experience. But it also means that the model of how we operate is different. So all of our employees, our full-time employees, are doing a lot of management of student employees. So their jobs look different. Then you have a lot of turnover because the students don't come and stay for 10 years. You're lucky if you get them for 2 years. Many of them you might only get for a semester. So you're doing a lot of training and retraining and retraining as you get a new crop of students. But it's really rewarding to work with these bright, energetic, talented students and to, you know, help them learn how to be successful in the world of work and try to set them up to go out and do well.
Well, you are, and this is one reason why I've wanted you to be on our podcast for so long. You are a model of success, Bridget, and I don't say that just to flatter you. You have broken some glass ceilings in your career, and one of those, of course, is you are the first female dean of BYU Merritt School. And so I want to ask you a little bit about that process. You're going into your third year of your position. So I'm sure that interview process began about 3 years ago or so. So can you give us, now that a little bit of time has passed, can you give us a little bit of peek into that history of how that process unfolded? Because you, as I say, you're a trendsetter. And when you were announced as the dean, there was terrific excitement on campus about it, but we never got really a peek as to how it all happened. So can you tell that story for us?
Sure. So at the time, I was a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and I had a fantastic job, and I had no plans of going anywhere. I wasn't looking for anything different, although I'd had this niggling feeling in my mind that change was going to happen. I thought it was going to be change at Harvard. Because I had this feeling, I was at least, I guess, open to thinking about different things. And I received an email from one of the faculty members here at the Merritt School saying, "We're looking for a new dean. Would you be interested?" And I read it and I thought, well, I'm not sure I would be a good fit for that role because I was at a public policy school, not at a business school. I have been at business schools in the past, but at the time I was in a public policy school and I didn't have a lot of strong connections with the business school here at BYU. I was an undergraduate here in the economics department. I had lots of good connections over there, but the economics department isn't part of the business school. But I decided that it had been a long time since I interviewed for a job. And so going through the process would be a really good experience for me. So there was an interview on Skype. And I think the people who were on campus, they made them do it in the same way. So literally everyone was having the same experience. And then they narrowed it down to four people and they invited us all out for a day, or in my case, it was more like a day and a half of visits on campus. And so I flew out, I had to do a presentation to the faculty and staff with Q&A. And then I had a lot of meetings, some one-on-one, some with groups of people, meeting with the academic vice president who was in charge of hiring me. And then a few weeks later, they offered me the job. And then I had a tough decision to make.
Well, and you said a moment ago, you said at first weren't sure if you were a good fit. And you had a tough decision to make. So would you mind giving us a little bit of a bigger peek into that? Why wouldn't you be a good fit in your mind? And obviously, you had a great position at Harvard. So was that part of the tough decision making?
Yeah, that was part of the decision making. When I came out here and was doing my, you know, day and a half dog and pony show, for me, that was as much about me deciding whether I was interested in the job as it was about BYU deciding whether they were interested in me. And in my background, I had spent significant time at two different business schools. So I was on the faculty at the University of Chicago for 8 years at their business school. And I was on the faculty of the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania for 3 years. And while I was at Harvard, I was doing part of my teaching in a joint degree program between the Harvard Kennedy School, which is the public policy school, and the business school. So, you know, I definitely had business school background. And in that sense, I didn't feel like it was crazy for them to be talking to me. But, you know, I hadn't spent my whole career in a business school. And, you know, my approach to the world is I think about things from a public policy standpoint. You know, how do we make the world a better place? As it turns out, I think that's actually a great outlook, a viewpoint to have for someone in this type of an administrative position where I'm trying to, you know, help all of the students in the business school succeed regardless of what they're majoring in, trying to, you know, help the whole college, not, you know, one department versus another. And also in terms of building connections and bridges and trying to help the university as a whole. So I think that background, you know, is relevant, but it's definitely not the traditional path that you see for business school deans. And there's been a learning curve, that's for sure. But I've felt very supported And I think it's been a great opportunity for me to learn new things. And I can see how the institution benefits from having someone come in from the outside. But I've also had to learn how to, when to bow to, you know, precedent and culture and things like that. And when to maybe push on, yeah, this is the way you've been doing things for a long time, but would you be open to considering an alternative?
What's been your biggest surprise since you've arrived on campus? Either, you know, positive surprise or one, maybe a disappointment that hasn't been yet realized, hasn't turned into a success yet. So after being on the job for a couple of years, what's kind of taken you by surprise, if I can ask that?
The biggest positive surprise is really realizing just how many people are out there who want to help. And, you know, I knew I would come in and we would have alumni who were supportive and there would be lots of people who would be interested in helping the institution succeed. But I completely underestimated how extensive that reservoir of goodwill is from the many, many, many friends of this institution out there in the world. And, you know, not a week goes by without several people reaching out and saying, what can I do to help? And for some of them, it's, how can I help financially? But for many of them, it's, what can I do to help mentor students? What can I do to help you as the dean? What can I do to move your initiatives along? What can I do to be an ambassador? And, you know, it's just really heartwarming to realize that you're not in this alone. You have this whole army of people and only a few of them are on your formal payroll.
You know, you talked a little bit about the background before joining BYU. So you started your professional career at Harvard, then you went to University of Chicago Business School, then to Wharton, then back to Harvard, and then eventually, of course, now to BYU. May I ask, were you recruited for each of those moves? Because I think people would be surprised to learn that a recruitment process takes place in academia. I think kind of the old stereotype is we have staid professors who just kind of stay hunkered down in their office and come out and teach and then go back and do research. But it sounds like in your case, there was a lot of movement professionally, a lot of opportunities being presented to you. Is that how it worked in your case? You were just kind of doing your thing and they found you?
Yeah, there is definitely recruiting that goes on in the academic world. And I feel really lucky to have had the professional trajectory that I've had. Over the years, I've worked at a lot of really interesting places and learned a lot of important things from those different institutions. And, you know, I think it's good to be able to compare and contrast, you know, what did I like about this place that I want to bring going forward? And what do I like about the experience that I had there? And I think there are definitely a lot of people in academia who haven't moved around. But when I'm talking to students, you know, particularly, you know, graduate students who are going off and graduating and get their first job, I tell them not to be afraid of moving. You're not interviewing for the job you're going to keep for the next 30 years of your life. You're interviewing for something you're going to do for the next few years. And now I tell that to the students here at BYU Marriott, because I think, you know, I think a lot of them, they're graduating and really focused on that first job coming out of school, like it's the only job they're ever going to have. And they better get that decision right because they're going to be living with it for 30 or 40 years. And I find myself doing a lot of recalibrating. No, you're taking a job for 2, 3, maybe 5 years if you're lucky. Find a job that's going to give you good experience for a few years and then get all that you can out of it and think about what do you want to do? What do you want to do next?
I like how you are encouraging people to kind of pushing them out of the nest, because one of BYU's themes, its slogan is enter to serve and go, repeat it for me, Bridget.
Enter to learn, go forth to serve. And then there's another motto that's at one entrance of campus.
Yes.
And then at another campus entrance, it's the world is our campus. So I refer to those mottos a lot. We want our students to go out into the world and learn what they can. You know, certain things you can learn on campus, but if the world is our campus, we're not just learning about the world on campus. We need to go out into the world and make the world our campus and go forth and serve other places as well. And, you know, I grew up I spent most of my growing up years here in Utah County. My father was a sociology professor here on campus when I was growing up. So I literally grew up on this campus. I went to the preschool program that is on campus. I started here when I was four. But, you know, I wouldn't trade the experiences that we had living in Boston, living in Chicago, living in Philadelphia, you know, for anything. I learned so many valuable things living those other places. And then when I was 14, when I was in high school, my father led a 6-month study abroad program in Europe. And so took the family and with a group of 30 college students, you know, we spent 6 months traveling around Europe, and that was eye-opening. So I definitely would encourage our students to go out and live someplace different, learn something, make new friends, you know, learn about the people in a different part of the country or a different part of the world. And eventually maybe you'll, you know, come back to Utah, if that's what you love, or go back someplace else. We've got students from all 50 states and dozens of foreign countries, but don't be afraid of living someplace different and going a little bit outside your comfort zone. That's how you learn.
And speaking of learning, maybe you could share with us one or two examples. What did you learn while on the campus, say at Harvard or at Wharton, that you are trying to bring into the BYU culture and within the Tanner building that we see behind you right now? What are some lessons or some things that you saw or were part of there that we should expect to see as part of the culture here at BYU Marriott?
I think one of the most important things I learned from moving around different places is that the culture, the corporate culture, is different. And it can be dramatically different, but you can shape it. You can have an influence on it. So my first job in the Harvard Economics Department, so this is when I was in my mid-20s, straight out of graduate school, and it was a very isolating culture. It was an environment where you were, you know, people were kings unto themselves, and they put the junior faculty down in a little hallway on the first floor. We were all off by ourselves, didn't have a lot of interaction with other people. So I learned that the physical geography really influences who you talk to. And then I went to the University of Chicago, the business school there, and the culture was completely different. So they had a culture where everyone got together for lunch. You know, you'd have 20 people eating lunch together, either in the, you know, faculty common room, which had seating for a whole bunch of people. People would just show up there for lunch, or there was a faculty club and, you know, big groups of people would go over there for lunch. And I learned so much over the 8 years I was there just from having lunch with colleagues who were in different disciplines. And I loved that. I loved that ability to meet people who thought about things differently and learn from them and get to know them. And so then when I went to the University of Pennsylvania at the Wharton School, it was kind of like halfway between Harvard and Chicago. But I went in and I said, the department I was in, we moved floors in the building shortly after I got there. And so I said, well, before we bake everything in stone, what if we set up a lounge area where people can just come together and hang out? Because they didn't have that. And I had seen how influential that was at the University of Chicago. So I was able to actually shape that with my department at the University of Pennsylvania. So, you know, now since I've been the dean at the Marriott School, having these different experiences with what the culture is like and what kind of an impact that has on how people feel about their job and whether or not they're excited to come to work and things like that, you know, that's been on my mind. And I've been thinking about that both in terms of the students and in terms of the faculty and the staff. So when I first came in, I didn't know any of the students because I came in from the outside. So I was thinking, okay, how am I going to get to know the students? And then we did some work early on after I got here, trying to come up with what our strategic objectives were going to be. And we did some interviewing and discovered that a lot of students across campus were afraid of the Tanner Building, where the business school is housed. They viewed this as this big, intimidating place, and students in that building wore suits to class sometimes. And I thought, well, how am I going to get people to major in business if they're afraid to walk in the building? That's not any good. So, you know, we spent a lot of time trying to think about how can we just make the physical space feel more open and welcoming and less intimidating. And as it turned out, it didn't take a lot of work. We just decided to start doing things that were fun and, you know, get the deans out, meet the students. So we're not scary, hand out donuts, you know, hand out candy on Halloween, decorate the building for different holidays, you know, just try and make it seem more fun. And I've received dozens of, you know, emails and handwritten notes and LinkedIn messages from students saying, literally things like, I used to be afraid to walk in the Tanner Building, and now I'm telling my friends to come over here and hang out with me because it feels so different. And then I guess not quite a year ago, when COVID hit and the world changed, we had to send all the students home. Faculty and staff were now working from home. You know, I felt like we need to do something to still help people feel connected because we're not running into the hallways anymore. And, you know, I don't know how well I've done with this, but it was something that I was thinking about and decided we needed to be proactive. So we started doing town halls. And initially we did them every 2 weeks because we had a lot of information we had to convey, but it wasn't just about conveying information. It was also around trying to help people feel connected. And, you know, for several months, I was sending out an email every week, trying to, you know, create a sense of community, picking one or two people to spotlight. And those were all really intentional responses to the experiences that I had had over my previous places of employment with cultures that I thought helped people feel like they were part of a community and cultures that didn't do that. And so it wasn't necessarily pulling specific pieces in, but more pulling in this general idea that you can impact the culture and it makes a difference.
It does make a difference. I've noticed a difference. Now, I'm going to say you may not want me to tell the world, but I am an adjunct at the BYU Marriott School. Maybe you don't know that, Bridget. That's why I still have my job. But but I enjoy, I'm now in my fourth year of teaching, and I just teach one class. But I've noticed, because you've included adjuncts as well as the full-time faculty in those town halls, and it's been a world of difference. And, you know, I think maybe you were hired at the right time in the right position because you've been able to create that connection and that sense of community through, I think, even enhanced communication channels. So I thank you for that.
And we'll get back to our interview in just a moment. But at BMW, they didn't make just one SUV. They made the ultimate range SUV. With unmatched power, luxury, and performance, BMW X-Range is prepared for any road you travel. No matter who you are, no matter where you're going, no matter what's next, there's an X to take you there.
Let me ask you a little bit more about culture, because I think if someone was to ask me what difference has Dean Madrian made so far in her tenure, I would have to say, well, the first thing that comes to my mind is culture. Now, because of your, as I said earlier, kind of breaking through the glass ceiling of the Tanner Building as the first woman dean, I think you have sensitivities that perhaps some of us don't. And one of those sensitivities that you've brought, which has really been front and center as far as your town hall discussions, has been how we need to be very intentional about diversity and inclusion. So can you share with us a little bit of your thinking on that? And where does that come from? Does it come from top down and you're just the messenger? Or is it part of your makeup and part of your background, and you see that as maybe a gap we need to fill?
Well, I don't think those are mutually exclusive. I think it's a little bit of both. So, you know, one of the decisions I had to make when I came here was, what are my priorities going to be? And I realized that as the first female dean, there were going to be people looking at me and watching to see how I approach this job through the lens of diversity and inclusion. And I could decide that I wanted to embrace that, or I could decide that I just wanted to focus on kind of more traditional things that a dean might focus on. And I decided, you know, what's the point of coming in and being the first female dean if you can't, you know, if you can't use that as a platform to, you know, create a more inclusive culture. And, you know, from my background, that would be with respect to gender, but I think we need to be inclusive more, you know, more broadly. That's the piece of it I have felt personally. But, you know, I've also through my career seen how inclusion benefits organizations and how different people have been impacted when they felt more or less included. And I think my experience at the Harvard Kennedy School is really influential there. So the Harvard Kennedy School, about 40% of the students were international. So we had students from all over the world, and it was a joy. It was really wonderful to teach them and learn from them. Really, I learned so much from these students who came from all over. But because we had students from so many different backgrounds, there were a lot of discussions around diversity and inclusion, you know, on the basis of all sorts of different metrics. But I also saw some of the challenges that Harvard was having with diversity and inclusion. And at a public policy school, you have a lot of students who are interested in changing the world. So I spent 13 years with these students who, you know, came in because they wanted to change the world. And we accepted them because we thought they had the potential to actually do that. And that culture is not quite as ingrained in most business schools. But I think it helped me realize that, you know, you can actually affect change. If you have a strong leader who believes in something, you can actually affect change. So when I came in, I decided that was going to be one of the things that we were going to focus on. And I think, you know, I started talking about it from day one. I started talking about it before I even arrived. And things really, for me, took on a new sense of urgency last June with the Black Lives Matter protests after the death of George Floyd. And I had this moment where I realized that I had been talking about it, and I think talking about it in a way that was different than had been in the past, but it wasn't enough, and that we needed to do more. And that's where I really decided we needed to talk about it more often. We needed to talk about it in concrete and specific ways, and we needed to make everyone feel a sense of accountability for this. So, you know, I think you see a lot of organizations and they'll bring in, you know, chief diversity officer or diversity and inclusion manager, and that person becomes responsible for diversity and inclusion in the organization. And then you've got one person who's thinking about it. But if you really want to affect change, you need everyone to be thinking about what they can do and how they can do things differently. And so that's kind of the culture change that I've been trying to affect, is that it's not just me in the dean's office thinking about it. It's not the diversity and inclusion manager that we did hire last March, and she's got specific things that are part of her job. But I really need everyone to be thinking about it, and we need to create a sense of accountability around it. And so here at the university, January, February, beginning of March is performance evaluation season. And so this year in the business school, we're trying to make a discussion around diversity and inclusion part of every single performance evaluation interview that happens. So we've, you know, sent all of the full-time employees who are part of this process diversity and inclusion accountability checklist. It's 4 pages long, and it's just lists of things. Here are things you could be doing as an individual, as a department, as a program, as an administrative unit. And what are you doing? And what are you going to try and do better this next year so that people feel some accountability? We're also giving them some ideas. They don't have to figure it out on their own. Here are, you know, 50 things you could do. And then we're creating conversations around it, and everyone's involved, not just one person or a handful of people. And we've started to see change, and change happens slowly. It's not going to happen overnight, but we've started to see meaningful change in how people are thinking about things and what they're doing. And that's been really rewarding, because I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's what we need to do. It's the right thing to do. And it's happening. And I feel really lucky to be a part of it.
Well, I would note, too, you indicated that you hired the diversity inclusion manager in March, where socially speaking, it really wasn't front and center in, you know, an American dialogue until the summer. So you were obviously ahead of it, if you will. Let me ask you this, though. In a private institution such as BYU, we have something that we call the honor code. And so the honor code requires both staff and, of course, students to make commitments that they will live a certain type of life. And when I say that, I mean standards, that they will maintain certain standards. So I know you find it a plus because it just elevates the quality of individuals that we find on campus. But it's also got to be a challenge because in order for diversity and inclusion to really work, someone coming to BYU, considering BYU, also has to make the commitment that they will raise their own standards. So how does that fit into your overall plan or the vision that you've got to improve in this area?
Boy, that's a big question. So I think when a lot of people think about the honor code at BYU, they focus on what I would call the visible aspects of the honor code. So for example, men can't wear a beard here on this campus. And we have certain standards about dress. We expect people to dress nicely, for example. There's no smoking. You know, I think so people are very focused on those really visible things. And I do think they're important. And I think they, you know, I think they make a difference. And, you know, I've seen the things like that even outside of the context of BYU. So for example, my oldest daughter spent preschool, kindergarten, and first grade at a Catholic school, and they had to wear a uniform. And there were lots of good things about that. You know, so there are lots of reasons that organizations put in honor code or a dress code or things like that. But I think the really the most important part of the honor code at BYU is there's a phrase in there about respect for others. We need to have respect for others. And I think that's how it ties into diversity and inclusion, not just with respect to things that are typically part of the diversity and inclusion, gender, race, things like that. But, you know, I think over this last year, we've seen a lot of political divisions in this country and a lot of, you know, not respect for others when it comes to people who have differences of opinion. And if you want an organization to function well and you want to get the most out of all of your people, they need to feel like they can come to work and express their opinions and be respected for that. But they also have to be able to come and express their opinions in a respectful way that doesn't demean others. And that's a skill. That's not something that most of us are born with. That's a skill that you learn from being empathetic, from being secure, you know, from having a strong sense of self-esteem and being secure in how you feel about yourself. So you don't have to elevate yourself over someone else, even if they disagree with you, from being willing to listen, having self-control and self-restraint if you don't agree. You know, I think all of that is part of respecting others, giving place for someone else to come in and have a difference of opinion. And that's much more important than, you know, did you shave this morning or not? And I wish that would be, you know, a bigger focus on campus. And it's not that it isn't a focus. There are lots of people on campus who are focused on that. That's really what we need to be striving for. And it's making us better people. I mean, isn't that what we want, is to become better people, to grow and develop and become better people? And part of that is learning how to interact with others and respect them and love them, even if they're completely different from us.
I really admire the way you position that, the way you teach that. And going back to the motto, enter to learn. So when people enter campus to learn, it's not just from the textbook, but it's from their classmates and from their instructors and from events that we have on campus and so forth. And I really appreciate also what you are building and what you're still working to build within the Marriott School, because unfortunately, and maybe these are just anecdotal, but unfortunately, we're hearing too much around academia or college campuses specifically, increasingly this notion that if you don't have the right opinion, then your opinion doesn't matter. In fact, it might even need to be snuffed out. So I think what you're suggesting and what you're demonstrating through your tenure thus far is that no, all opinions, all styles, all personalities, all belief systems are welcome here, as long as, go back to the honor code, as long as we're all willing to live a certain standard, because that will make a better learning environment. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a fair way of saying it.
And if I could, Bridget, about the students. So not so much the students you have today on campus, but the students of tomorrow, those who are considering BYU, who may want to transfer or, you know, begin their college career at BYU. You're an educator before you're an administrator. I have to ask you, from your vantage point, is there anything that concerns you about today's incoming students? Anything that you would either ask them or caution them to watch out against or stop doing or start doing that will make college a better experience for them, that can actually turn into the kind of life and career that they envision?
Yeah. One of the trends that is true on this campus and on almost every other college campus in this country is a dramatic increase in the fraction of students with behavioral and mental health problems. I think part of that's driven by universities being better set up to serve students who have those challenges to begin with. So, you know, more of those students are coming to campus and succeeding, whereas in the past, they might have never come to college or they would have dropped out early on. And that's good. But a lot of it's just an overall trend in behavioral and mental health problems amongst young adults across the country. And, you know, I see those challenges up front. I see them in the students we have. I hear about them when I talk to employers. You know, the employers that hire our students are talking about the challenges that they're having with the, you know, recent college graduates from schools from across the country and the challenges that they're having in the transition from school to work related to behavioral and mental health. So, you know, it's part of the broader ecosystem. And, you know, I see a lot of students, they're really focused on achievement rather than on learning. And when they're focused on achievement and then they don't measure up, I think that's where they start getting into trouble. So a concrete example would be, you know, they're graduating and they're looking for a job and they feel like there's a pecking order out there. And if you don't get a job at this particular company, then something's wrong with you and you've failed. And that's not a really healthy attitude to have, because there are lots of ways to be successful in the world. And as we were talking about earlier, hardly anyone's going to stay at the first job they get out of school for more than a few years. And I would much rather have my students focused on what can I learn? What skills am I trying to acquire? And what can I learn? You know, what kind of technical skills that can I learn that are going to make me valuable as an employee? What kind of interpersonal skills can I learn will help me be more effective, both in the workplace and in my personal relationships? And how can I just become a better person and use school as an opportunity for personal development and growth rather than as a yardstick to try and assess how I measure up? Because the former, like, what can I learn? How can I grow? Lots of good research from psychology that's a healthy attitude. You'll be happier. You'll be more productive. And that's really the goal we all want. You know, it's not what's the name on the top of your resume. It's not the size of your paycheck. It's how happy are you? How fulfilled are you? Are you finding meaning in your work, in your personal relationships, with your family? That's what success is. And we need to do a better job of helping our students understand what success is and what success isn't.
I'm no sociologist, but it makes me think that perhaps the social media culture that we're growing up in, where your social media post is kind of like your daily grade as to how you're doing socially and socioeconomically, perhaps that's feeding that tendency. You can kind of see if someone is having a good day based on their social media post, if they're popular that day, if they won a big something at school or at work. So maybe that's a contributing factor, but I really appreciate what you're suggesting here is that we have to take the long view. And that what the purpose of a university education, in fact, forgive me if this is contrary to what you teach, but I say to some people who ask me, which degree should I get? With all apologies to the business school, I'd say it doesn't really matter as long as you get a degree that demonstrates that you're in the process of learning. You know how to learn because you'll never stop learning throughout your life. And you may get a degree in engineering tomorrow, but in 2 years, you could be working in sales. So I hope that's aligned with your thinking as well and your advice.
Yeah, well, I think if someone were to ask me that question, I'd say get a degree in something that gets you excited to get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. And you spoke about how we as individuals kind of have a pecking order that sometimes we get caught up in. Now, not to turn your words against you, but at BYU, we are always very concerned about rankings and accreditation. It's kind of our measuring stick, isn't it, as to how well we're doing compared to our peers out in the world of academia. So from an administrative point of view, can you give us, again, some insight into how BYU and the Marriott School in particular looks at rankings? Because I know in many categories, we're ranked very high and something that we're all proud of, but we can't get complacent about. How do rankings work into your setting goals for the institution? And what are some of the differentiators BYU has that makes us so highly ranked in certain categories?
That's a great question. And shortly before I started my job, I had a meeting with my boss, the academic vice president, and I'd been talking to deans from a lot of other business schools from across the country. And the common story was that they had been hired either to move their school up in the rankings, typically the MBA program, or they had been hired to go out and raise money, fundraising. And after having all these conversations, I thought, well, I better find out my boss, this man who's hired me, what does he expect me to do? You know, what is success going to look like in his book? So I went and explained this all to him. And I said, well, how are you going to decide whether or not I'm succeeding? What does doing my job well actually look like? And it was clear that no one had ever asked him that question in that way before. And he hemmed and hawed for a few minutes. And he finally said, well, you know, it's not all about rankings. I don't want you to go chase the rankings. I want the school to do well, but it's not about rankings and it's not about fundraising. I just want you to deal with the problems that are over in the business school and do the best that you can. And that was great to hear from him, that that's not what he was concerned about. So there are a lot of different rankings that are out there and they're constructed in different ways. And some of the things that go into the rankings, honestly, I really don't care about. And I don't think we should be focused on. And there are other things that don't show up in the rankings that I think we absolutely should be focused on. So, for example, some of the rankings factor in things like starting salary of your graduates. And starting salary is, you know, it's not an irrelevant metric. Certainly our students are going out and getting jobs and we'd like them to be paid well for what they're doing. You know, but if someone is taking a job in New York City and they're getting paid 25% more than someone who's taking a job in Dallas because the cost of living is lower in Dallas. Do I really care about that difference? No, I don't personally. And if someone would rather live in Dallas because it's got a lower cost of living and they can buy a house and start raising a family earlier and it's going to bring them more joy and happiness, then I'd rather have them move to Dallas. So there are things like that that I don't really care that much about. And then there are other things that I care a lot about that don't explicitly show up in the rankings. So for example, Bloomberg Businessweek, which does a ranking of MBA programs, in 2018, they asked, and in doing these rankings, they do surveys of graduates. In 2018, they asked some additional questions that didn't actually go into the rankings, but they asked them and put out rankings just on those questions based on the student responses. And one of the questions was, my MBA program has inspired me to pursue an ethical career, something like that. That wasn't the exact wording, but close enough. And that the answer to that question was not used in the rankings that they put together for MBA programs. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to ask me how much do I care about the answer to that question relative to starting salaries, I care a lot more about knowing that our students have come out with a desire to be moral and ethical leaders in business than their starting salary. But one of those gets included in the rankings and one of those doesn't. Where did BYU end up? on inspiring students to pursue an ethical career, we were number one in the country on that one. I think you have to take the rankings with a grain of salt, and you have to decide, what do we stand for? And here at BYU Marriott, I think we stand for training leaders of faith, intellect, and character. And part of the character piece is we want our students to act with integrity. We want them to work hard. We want them to be good examples. We want them to be grateful. We want them to be humble. And those aren't all things that the rest of the world values the same way we do. But I feel like we should be setting a program that's true to the values we believe in. And if we do that, we'll do okay in the rankings.
Yeah.
The rankings will follow.
That's encouraging as a member of your staff. I appreciate that explanation and that point of view. Now, speaking of point of view, you have an extensive library of research and papers that you've written in really your core area of expertise long before you became the dean at BYU Marriott. You're an expert in behavioral economics, household finance. I hope I'm describing it correctly. And I would encourage my audience to do a little research into your writings because they are vast and extensive. I don't know how much you're able to do that anymore. I suspect not much in your current role. And by the way, Dean Madrian, are you able to teach even today as a dean at the Marriott School?
I am not teaching any classes, but I do take advantage of every opportunity I can to interact with students. And I feel like I get a lot of those opportunities, and that kind of brings me the same joy that I got out of being in the classroom, but I don't have to write exams and grade papers. So I'm okay with that trade-off.
I do want to tap into your expertise as we begin to wrap up here. I want to tap into that expertise that you've got because I think it could be helpful to this audience and frankly, anyone. In this unusual economy we're going through right now, hopefully we're starting to see some semblance of normalcy returning. Who knows? What is some advice or maybe even an observation from your vantage point that you can give us as it relates to how a business or a household can adjust to this new economy and the changing world that the pandemic is creating for us? What are some lessons that, you know, if you were a financial advisor, what might you tell us, again, if we're running a household or running a business?
Great question. So when people ask me what I do research on, my little tagline is, I do research on all the ways that individuals and households screw up in managing their money and how institutions like employers and the government can help facilitate better outcomes. And we've seen a lot of interesting things going on in the country lately in financial markets, in, you know, the decisions that households and families are making. And a couple of lessons that kind of come out of my research and the research of others who work in this area is a lot of times we overreact to changes that happen. And a lot of times that overreaction we actually don't benefit from that in the long run. So, you know, a really good example would be a couple of weeks ago, what was happening with GameStop in the stock market. And prices were changing and people were overreacting, and some of them were overreacting by buying into the stock and some of them were shorting the stock. And there was a lot of psychology fueling investment decisions that weren't really based on what the, you know, underlying economic prospects of this company were in the long term. And you saw some people making millions of dollars and you saw hedge funds losing billions of dollars. Those are the types of things that people who were in this behavioral economics and household finance space are studying. And, you know, there are very few decisions that you really need to make on the spur of the moment when it comes to managing your money. And we're almost always better off by stepping back, not making rash, quick decisions and taking the long view. So when people ask me about investment advice, you know, vast body of literature suggests that most people are really lousy investors. They buy in at the wrong point and they sell at the wrong point. Instead of buying low and selling high, they buy high and they sell low. We're just not very good at timing the market. You're much better off with just investing a little bit continuously, buy and hold long-term strategy. And you'll do well enough. And if you're not greedy and you're not trying to be at the top of the totem pole, That strategy will save you a lot of stress and grief, and you'll do well by it. You know, you'll do well by it at the end of the day. And I think the other thing we've seen in the last year, I do a lot of research on saving, and, you know, a lot of stuff that has come out of that is many households are not saving enough. And I think we've seen some really interesting disparities when it comes to saving over the last little while. So on the one hand, we've had households who have, you know, good white collar jobs where it's easy to work from home, and they've been relatively unaffected in terms of their income by the recession. But the pandemic means that they haven't been able to travel. They're eating from home instead of going out to restaurants and things like that. And they were working in jobs where they had a retirement savings plan to begin with, and their savings rates have gone way up. So they're actually saving a lot more as a result of the pandemic. And then kind of on the flip side, we have households in more blue collar jobs, much more impacted by the pandemic, more likely to be subject to layoffs, didn't have access to a retirement savings plan at work, didn't have other savings, and they've been really hit hard by this recession and the pandemic-induced recession. So the economy has kind of really laid bare the fact that we have, you know, winners and losers in society, and kind of even widened the gaps between those two groups. And I think really highlighted the need to come up with better institutions that facilitate savings throughout the income distribution, not just for, you know, higher educated white collar workers, but that really benefit everyone.
It's obvious we could do a whole new episode just on your expertise in this one topic. So I really appreciate that. And again, encourage people to do a little poking into the writings that you have done over the many years that you've been in academia. So thank you for those insights. I know these questions, some of them have been a little bit surprise and maybe a curveball here and there. I'm not trying to fool you or anything like that, but I want to end on two quick questions if we could. As you know, Game Face Execs podcast is really, it's centered around how individuals persuade, influence, and inspire, and also how they are persuaded and influenced and inspired. So I'd like to start by asking you, Bridget, if you could, in your career, in your life, today or in the past, can you just share with us one example of someone or something that has inspired you?
I mean, I feel like I've been lucky. I've had a lot of good people that I've looked to for inspiration. One person, he probably will not listen to this podcast, but if he does, I'm sure he'll be shocked to hear this. I had a really amazing advisor in graduate school named Jim Paterba, and he was very generous with his time. He was very encouraging and supportive, and he has a whole army of former graduate students who are now working as academics or professional economists throughout the country. And he's now the head of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the largest economic think tank in the country, puts out lots of influential research, runs dozens and dozens and dozens of conferences, and has, I think, done an exceptional job at creating an environment where economic research can flourish and inspiring people to do high quality research that has an impact on the world, at mentoring junior scholars and giving them the training and support that they need. And I certainly felt that from him. And, you know, he's influenced how I do research, but he's also influenced, you know, my leadership and how I interact with other people. And he's been someone that I've, you know, had the good fortune to interact with for over three decades now. And that's been a really meaningful relationship in my life.
Thank you for that. And also thank you for the lead. We're going to have to reach out to Jim and make sure he becomes a listener of this podcast. My last question for you. I don't wish this upon you, but let's say that someday we have to write something on the inscription of your tombstone, your headstone. And it's going to say, Bridget influenced. And how would you finish that sentence for us?
Well, I think I would change the influenced. I would hope it would say, Bridget inspired people to be better.
Enough said. That's great. Really appreciate everything you've shared with us. Again, congratulations on the position that you have now and the influence that you have on the BYU campus and in the Marriott School specifically. Thank you for all your work and scholarship, and thank you for your work as a leader. So appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. We'll see you on campus, and also hope that when we cross paths in the hallway, you won't avoid me next time.
Thank you, Rob, and I would never avoid you.
I know. I'm teasing you. Thanks again, Bridget Madrian. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.